From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA international broadcaster and current affairs producer, Kim Lewis. Our topic on this edition of the program, how do the very different lives and characters of U.S. civil rights leaders Malcolm X and Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. intersect and overlap, despite their contrasting philosophies and tactics regarding racial inequality? Did they have more in common than we think? Our guest on this edition of the program will shed light on that very conundrum. Peniel Joseph is author of the recently published book, The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Joseph asserts in his book that notwithstanding their very different family histories, religious affiliations, and class backgrounds, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King inspired each other throughout their adult lives. According to Joseph, quote, Malcolm was a political renegade, unafraid to identify racial justice in America as a systemic illness that required nothing less than the radical transformation of the political and racial status quo, closed quote. Malcolm X championed black pride, black power, and decried white institutions and citizens for what he called historic and contemporary racial crimes, close quote. In contrast, Dr. Martin Luther King is best known for his philosophy of nonviolence. As the foremost leader of the civil rights movement in America, Dr. Martin Luther King chose the tactic of nonviolence as the most effective tool in fighting against institutionalized racial segregation, discrimination, and inequality. Peniel Joseph, our guest, is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and Professor of History and the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas at Austin. He has written several books on African-American history, including Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, and Stokely, A Life, about the West Indian-born civil rights activist Stokely Carmichael, among several other books. Well, author and professor Peniel Joseph joins us via Skype as we all continue to practice social distancing measures due to the coronavirus pandemic. Peniel Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, international broadcaster and current affairs producer, Kim Lewis.
Very happy to be here.
So, Peniel Joseph, my first question to you is, what prompted you to write this book and find these points of convergence between these very two different civil rights leaders?
Well, I've really been studying the civil rights movement and African-American history my whole life. And I've written several previous books, like you mentioned, about the civil rights movement, black power, social justice movements from the 1950s and 1960s, including a book about Barack Obama and his connection to those movements as well. So in a lot of ways, doing the research that I've done over the years and decades now gave me a really big interest into learning more about Malcolm X and Dr. King. And the deeper I did the research, the more I saw a convergence rather than divergence.
So because in your book you describe MLK, Martin Luther King, as more of the nonviolent insider, you know, he promulgated movement of nonviolence in the face of racial inequality, and you characterize Malcolm as the outsider, he's known as by any means necessary type of a political renegade. But you say in the end that their relationship defied the myths about their politics and activism. How so?
Well, both of these political icons and leaders, they evolve over time. And I think the nature of the book, it's a dual biography, so it lets you really compare and contrast and see their intersections side by side. The first couple of chapters are biographical, and then you really get into their political careers, and you look at them the same week, the same year, the same month, and the way in which they crisscross really the entire world talking about social justice. So King's notion of what I call radical black citizenship over time converges with Malcolm's notion of what I call radical black dignity. And Malcolm is really a representative of the third world and this idea of this titanic struggle between the global north and global south. And in the context of the post-war period, the way in which billions of people indigenously around the world were asserting their freedom. You think about the 1955 Bandung Afro-Asian Conference, the non-alignment movement, anti-colonial struggles in Africa, but really the larger third world and the Caribbean. Malcolm is representing that group, including African Americans in the United States, and making this argument for radical Black dignity, by which he means the end to racial violence and racial oppression that's happening globally. Dr. King is talking about something similar, but with different points of emphasis. King talks about radical Black citizenship. King is preaching a philosophy, a beloved community, a community free of racial oppression, free of economic injustice. But he says that citizenship is not just the freedom from racial segregation and Jim Crow, but citizenship is a guaranteed living wage. It's decent housing. It's racially integrated public schools and neighborhoods. It's the end of poverty and also the end of war. That's what he argues. And over time, even as they start out with a lot of tension, they come to see that you really need both. You need radical dignity and radical citizenship globally for social change to happen. And when we watch the evolution of their careers, really by 1963, you're going to see some real major overlap between the two of them.
Dr. Joseph, in your research, when you were researching the childhoods of both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., what did you find in their childhoods that were some potential factors that made them the men that they grew up to be?
They have very much contrasting childhoods. Of course, Malcolm X, his father is murdered by white supremacists in Lansing, Michigan in 1931 when Malcolm Little is only 6 years old. His mother is institutionalized in a psychiatric facility for really most of Malcolm's entire life. So his family is fractured. And his family had been Black nationalists. They had been Pan-Africanists. They had been followers of Marcus Garvey, who was the Jamaican Pan-Africanist, founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. So Malcolm has a harsh childhood. He grows up in both Omaha, Nebraska, and Lansing, Michigan. But by the time he's 15, he leaves foster care. He's 15 years old. He's already well over 6 feet. He's going to grow into 6'3". He goes to see his half-sister, Ella Mae Collins, in Boston, and he lives in the Roxbury section of Boston. So racial trauma absolutely scars Malcolm X. Martin Luther King Jr. has a different upbringing completely. He is raised along Sweet Auburn Avenue, really a son and a prince of the Black upper middle class. His father, Martin Luther King Sr., is the head pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, one of the most influential Black churches in the United States in Atlanta. And his mother is coming from generations of African Americans who have been elites. His father was a sharecropper and the son of a sharecropper, but on his mom's side, he's an elite. And what we see with Dr. King is that he gets the best education. He goes to Morehouse College at the age of 15. But both of them face racism. And one of the interesting anecdotes that I tell in the book is the way in which they both have vivid memories of 1939 and seeing Gone with the Wind, and seeing the film Gone with the Wind scars both of them. Dr. King talks about how Gone with the Wind premiered in Atlanta, and he remembers how many people came out to see it. But when he saw it, he found all the racism and the way in which Black people are portrayed in that sepia-toned film about racial slavery. He found it very disconcerting. Malcolm says he saw it in a theater in Mason, Michigan. And he says when Butterfly McQueen, who plays one of the enslaved women who's constantly being berated by Vivian Leigh, the white protagonist, he says when Butterfly McQueen went into her act, I almost crawled under my seat. So he's humiliated by Gone with the Wind. So they both face racism and racial segregation. But certainly Dr. King sees a lot of Black figures, both men and women, who become role models for him in Atlanta, and education and having that access becomes key. Being part of the Black church in these institutions, Morehouse College, historically Black school. Malcolm, really, he finds his role models initially on the streets of Roxbury in Boston, Massachusetts, and also Harlem. And Malcolm is going to end up in prison from 1946 to 1952. At the very moment that Dr. King is at Morehouse College and Crozier Theological Seminary, Malcolm X is in prison at three different prisons, Norfolk State, Concord Reformatory, and Charlestown, Massachusetts. And he's going to find his role models within the context of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. And Malcolm is a prison organizer. And so Malcolm's political career really starts around 1948, 49, 50. He's a prison organizer and continues all the way to his death in 1965.
Well, Dr. Joseph, what is it about the Nation of Islam that while he was in prison that drew him to this religion compared to all of the other religions that he had been exposed to in prison? This was the one that he was drawn to the most, as is many other, especially African-American men who are in prison. What is it about that religion?
Well, that religion calls for self-determination. It grows out of Garveyism and Marcus Garvey's UNIA. It provided Malcolm a chance to both heal his fractured family and also a chance to find out about his own racial identity. So when we think about the Nation of Islam, there's something both radical and conservative about the Nation of Islam. The small c conservatism is the fact that the nation is very patriarchal in its organization. Women are supposed to be caretakers and heads of the family. Men are supposed to really assume a kind of black patriarchy that they've been disallowed from assuming because of white supremacy, racial slavery, and racial violence. So it's very appealing, the Nation of Islam, to a black young man like Malcolm X, who's 20 years old when he enters prison, to try to reclaim an identity that has been lost and really claim a measure of dignity as well. Malcolm graduated from the eighth grade and never completes formal education, but becomes this brilliant speaker and social activist, and it's the Nation of Islam that really provides a path for him to study black history, to start thinking about social change and social transformation in a systemic and really global way. You know, the Nation of Islam introduces him to African history and Islamic history and the history of the world. He starts reading Shakespeare and the history of Europe. So it's a very interesting and effective tool for him to empower himself through a religion that's both sectarian but also very secular. Malcolm's going to use that organization to get into and try to change the political landscape of both the United States and the entire world.
There is a difference, however, right, between obviously the Nation of Islam and then mainstream Islam. I think it's important to make that distinction.
Yes, certainly. The Nation of Islam was a very idiosyncratic and very unique practice and offshoot of the Islamic faith. It was the Islamic faith as considered and taught by both the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and W.D. Farad, who had been the founder of the group, but disappeared in 1930s Detroit. So it's a group that's coming out of the Great Depression and has its own mythology about race relations, the creation of white supremacy, and what black people need to do to support themselves and build parallel institutions. And eventually, Malcolm, by 1964, on the Hajj, is going to become an Orthodox Muslim after taking the pilgrimage to Mecca in the spring of 1964.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Peniel Joseph, author of the recently published book, The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. And we're coming to you via Skype as we all continue to practice social distancing due to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA international broadcaster and our current affairs producer, Kim Lewis. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to our loyal Facebook fan, Femi Bamiduro from Ibadan in Oyo State, Nigeria. Thanks, Femi. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We look forward to hearing from you more than ever as we all face the pandemic. Please tell us how you're doing. Well, back to our special guest, Peniel Joseph, author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. We were just talking about Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam before the break. Peniel Joseph, let's go back to these two icons of the civil rights movement. They were contemporaries. Did they develop any type of friendship or relationship throughout their lives and as they pursued their very different tactics to achieve racial equality? Did they cross paths?
Well, in fact, they did, but not in the way most people think about the development of relationships. So they met one time in person, March 26, 1964, while the U.S. Senate was filibustering the 1964 Civil Rights Act that's eventually passed on July 2nd. And Dr. King is holding a press conference. Malcolm X listens to the press conference in the back of a room on a couch in the U.S. Senate. And when they leave, they run into each other. They shake each other's hands. They have small talk. And their surrogates make plans for them to meet again, but they never physically meet again in close proximity like that again. Although Malcolm actually does listen to Dr. King give a speech in Harlem later that year, December 17th, after Dr. King has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And Malcolm is sitting next to Andy Young, who's one of King's lieutenants, Ambassador Andrew Young, who later becomes mayor of Atlanta and the United Nations ambassador. And when we think about their relationship, they become each other's alter egos in the sense that they are constantly listening to the other's speeches and organizing and reacting. Malcolm famously calls at times Dr. King in the early 60s, especially an Uncle Tom, a race traitor. He calls the March on Washington a farce on Washington. King speaks out against Malcolm and says that black supremacists are bad as white supremacists. And this is keeping in line with the mythology of the Nation of Islam as sort of a reverse Ku Klux Klan that happens after the 1959 Mike Wallace documentary appears in the summer of 1959, The Hate That Hate Produced. So at first, they're very adversarial. There's a lot of tension. And really, what I argue in The Sword and the Shield is that Birmingham in 1963 really helps them set on a convergent pathway, because Birmingham becomes this global story of white violence against peaceful demonstrators. I think sometimes we think that's Selma in 1965, but it's not. It's really Birmingham, Alabama. 1963, the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, is the year everything changes in the United States, although the irony is that there's absolutely no civil rights legislation passed in 1963. But all the subsequent civil rights legislation that is passed in America is because of the year 1963.
And I enjoyed in your book when you said that James Baldwin, the iconic literary figure who knew both MLK, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X, he said that they increasingly shared a revolutionary political vision that bound them together less as adversaries than as colleagues, whose initial conflict gave way to a shared destiny. And of course, we want to get you to talk more about that shared destiny. But first, let's just talk about how each one of them contributed to the struggle for racial equality and black dignity. What would you say is the greatest single contribution to the civil rights movement by Malcolm X? What is his lasting legacy?
Well, certainly, Malcolm X's lasting legacy is twofold. He's the biggest global critic of white supremacy and racial imperialism in the second half of the 20th century. And he's also the biggest articulator of a positive vision of black and African identity around the world. So those things cannot be overstated. So they're not connected to policy in an overt way, but they really become institutionalized in part of policy when we think about the movement for black studies and the way in which Negroes become black and Afro-American and African because of Malcolm X's political activism. And that's globally across the world. When we think about Dr. King, his biggest contribution is going to be globally to reimagining the idea of African-American citizenship and really reimagining the idea of the world house, the entire world being part of a community that could be free of racial violence, free of poverty, free of war and strife. So King's notion of a beloved community that people had to struggle for is going to be his biggest legacy. And really, when we think about nonviolence, we never add that Dr. King talked about nonviolent civil disobedience. So that's what makes Dr. King connected to Gandhian traditions and revolutionary traditions. And the last two chapters of this book are called The Radical King and The Revolutionary King, because he really takes up Malcolm X's mantle of being this bold truth teller. And even though he never is an advocate of violence, his advocacy of civil disobedience, radical, revolutionary civil disobedience, even leading up to the Poor People's Campaign, is really going to contribute to his assassination and really contribute to the fall in popularity, because King is using nonviolence in a very, very coercive, muscular, and revolutionary way.
And Peniel Joseph, would you say that conversely, Malcolm X, particularly after his visit in 1964 after the Hajj, is it fair to say that he began to drop his more radical postures and then diverge from the more dogmatic Nation of Islam movement and become maybe closer to Martin Luther King? He didn't see Martin Luther King as weak as he did earlier, but rather came closer to his positions?
I'd say that Malcolm's positions broaden even before he leaves the Nation of Islam. I often tell people that when you think about joining a religion, it's like joining a political party, where in the United States, the parties are Democrat, Republican. In other countries, they're called different things, but you never agree entirely with the party. You use the party or religion to leverage and amplify your own voice. You might want to be a missionary and help poor people, so you're part of this group. Malcolm was the same way. Malcolm's a brilliant intellectual. And sometimes even when you're saying the dogmatic party line, you're only saying it because you're part of this political or religious group. And privately, you feel differently. So I think that even as early as the early 1960s, he's converging with King's notion of radical black citizenship. I think it takes the complete break from the Nation of Islam for him to publicly state this in 1964. But as early as 1963 and before, Malcolm is in marches and in demonstrations, even though the Honorable Elijah Muhammad tells Muslims not to do that who are part of the Nation of Islam. Malcolm meets with Fidel Castro, and I have that in the book, in September of 1960, when reporters asked Elijah Muhammad, what is he thinking about the meeting? Elijah Muhammad says, if I had known he was going to meet Fidel Castro, I would have prevented it, which tells us that Malcolm didn't tell the Honorable Elijah Muhammad he was going to meet with Fidel Castro. He just went and met with him. So Malcolm's this global figure who is very much interested in organizing the Nation of Islam, not just around religion and spiritual faith, but around secular politics. And that's what gets him into trouble. So when we think about 64 and 65, the Hajj certainly broadens his mind, but I wouldn't say he becomes less radical. I'd say he actually becomes more radical because he starts to realize that to have radical and revolutionary transformations doesn't necessarily take violence. Violence is not synonymous with being a radical or a revolutionary. I think in his earlier iteration, he thought that they were synonymous. I think one of King's biggest lessons for Malcolm is that you can bring, whether it's America or the world's oppressive power, to their knees through nonviolent civil disobedience that becomes part of moral, political, and social suasion that leads to anti-racist public policies and anti-racist institutions.
Just looking at the world today, how relevant are these two men, especially to the younger generation? And what qualities of these men would the younger generation be able to identify with today?
I think they're unbelievably relevant to the world today, especially in the context of a global pandemic that we are all enduring. Their notion of radical dignity and citizenship was built through the particular lens of Black struggle, but it was very expansive. They're both human rights activists. Malcolm says that the civil rights movement should be a human rights movement. And Dr. King says that materialism, militarism, and racism are the triple threats facing humanity. So when we think about contemporary movements, whether they're for Black Lives Matter or women's marches, feminism, rights of immigrants and Muslims, rights of LGBTQ, they all stand on the shoulders of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. And I think the way in which they tried to reimagine both American democracy, but these ideas of citizenship and dignity are very, very crucial. Because when we think about contemporary movements, Dr. King's notion of citizenship is going to be so expansive that it's going to include people who are not American citizens. He thinks that we are all global citizens, and that's why he says he calls it the World House. So that includes all of us. And when you think about Malcolm, this idea of dignity, Malcolm famously says after coming back from Africa in 1964, one of two trips he took that lasted about 24 weeks, when the reporters tell him that a lot of whites are excited about his seeming change or transformation, saying that he's seen whites practice the Islamic faith in the Middle East, and he thinks that in terms of race relations, you can have interracial coalitions. He says that until every single Black person is accorded the same treatment, there's really not going to be racial equality and racial justice. So what those two give to younger people is really immense political integrity, examples of personal sincerity, and really this love of Black people, but also this love of poor people. They loved underdogs. Malcolm tried to organize Black people who were in prison. King slept on the floors of sharecropper shacks in Alabama and Mississippi. They weren't just talking the talk. They really walked the talk. And so I think that lesson of real commitment and the fact that Malcolm and King evolved, they both broadened their views to converge with the other. By 67, 68, Dr. King is saying Black is beautiful and we need Black pride and self-determination. By 1964, Malcolm is saying the ballot or the bullet, but he is for the first time saying that voting rights really matter and that Black people need to organize themselves to get access to citizenship. So they show us how when you're part of a social movement, you have to be able to evolve and broaden your view. And that evolution really is very, very important for us now, especially in light of the pandemic that has really uncovered the depth and breadth of racial disparity around the world.
Kim, do you have another question?
I was just going to say, in all of your research, what did you personally find most fascinating about the two men, whether it's something in their private lives or just as being influential civil rights movement influencers?
Yeah, I think what I found the most fascinating about each was how deeply intellectual and considered their approaches were. These were two people who were constantly reading. They were constantly listening as well as talking, so they could both be very attentive listeners. They were constantly expanding their vision of justice and including different people in. They both had blind spots when it came to gender and sort of gender racism and sexism and patriarchy. Malcolm grows over time. I think King does as well on this score. Malcolm by 64 is saying that the best countries he visited in Africa, African women are co-leaders and equal leaders and organizers, and that the Black liberation movement in the United States should follow that example. King doesn't go that far, but he starts to understand and listen to Black women who are welfare rights organizers who challenge and push him to admit that he doesn't know everything. He doesn't know all these issues, even as he's trying to lead an anti-poverty campaign. Black women like Johnny Tillman and Beulah Sanders knew the ins and outs of welfare legislation and social policy in a way that he did not. So I think that what's so interesting is how deeply committed they were, but how they are big thinkers. And when we think about them, we have to think about them as not just social movement leaders, not just men of faith, not just as spokespersons, but also as these public intellectuals who are really wrestling with these ideas of race, democracy, citizenship, imperialism, really globalization and what King called the World House, and how do you build this beloved community, but also racial slavery. I thought one of the interesting things about them is that, you know, the New York Times has a 1619 project about racial slavery and democracy from 1619 to the present. And both of them in their speeches, Malcolm first and then King over time, are laser-like focused. They cast a strobe light on racial slavery and Jim Crow racial segregation and American democracy, and really capitalism and imperialism struggles between the global North and global South in the 1960s. So it's amazing to me how deeply considered they both were in terms of, they were both students is the best way to describe them, lifelong students of history, of politics, society. And they're both amazing sociologists and anthropologists because they get along so well with different people in different settings. One of the interesting tidbits is that Malcolm X had an office at the United Nations. He knew all the African and the Middle Eastern and a lot of white diplomats. And he had an office there throughout most of the 1960s. And that's how he introduces Muhammad Ali to African diplomats that Muhammad Ali is going to use when he visits Africa in 1964 after being the youngest heavyweight champion in history.
Peniel Joseph is author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Peniel Joseph, congratulations on this fabulous book comparing the lives of two giants of the civil rights movement who had much more in common than we previously thought.
Carol, Kim, thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was VOA international broadcaster and current affairs producer Kim Lewis. I'm Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.